So was there ever a point where you would have said, all right, I'm gonna give up? Or what would that point have been when you wouldn't have tried again?
I don't think that point would have, you know, if I was disqualified and they said they wouldn't read my application, I probably would send it in anyway. I don't think I would have stopped, even to this day. You know, there's a chapter in the book, the first chapter is kind of some of the stories we're talking about now is one in a million is not zero. Even as long as you're trying, even if the odds are like very low, as long as you try it, that doesn't mean it's a zero outcome. It probably your success is non-zero. It's only when you give up that it becomes zero. So I felt as long as I was trying, there was a chance. And that's the only thing I could control. I couldn't force them to take me, to pick me, to select me. But I knew I could at least control my effort. So I think I just would have tried to keep going. One of the things that kept me going too was, as you say, it wasn't that I didn't interview well.
Welcome to Mentally Stronger, the show that will help you develop the mental strength you need to reach your greatest potential, no matter what life throws your way. I'm Amy Morin, psychotherapist, mental strength trainer, and an international best-selling author of 5 books on mental strength. Every Monday, I introduce you to a guest whose story and expertise can inspire you to think, feel, and do your best in life. And the fun part is, we record it all from a sailboat in the Florida Keys. Now, let's dive into today's episode. Do you have a dream that you haven't pursued? Have you given up on something because a challenge seemed insurmountable? Do you struggle to stay flexible when things don't go as planned? If so, today's episode is for you. I'm talking to Mike Massimino, a former astronaut and mechanical engineer professor at Columbia University. Mike's got a great story of beating the odds to become an astronaut and overcoming challenges that would have caused most of us to give up along the way. He's now written a new book called Moonshot, The Guide to Achieving the Impossible, which is about to hit the shelves. I got my hands on an advanced copy, and I loved his message. Some of the things he talks about today are how to overcome the fear of failure, how to persevere even when your challenges seem impossible, and how to keep loving life no matter what happens. Make sure to stick around until the end of the episode for the Therapist Take, where I'll give you my take on Mike's mental strength building strategies. So here's Mike Massimino on how to keep going when the odds are against you. Mike Massimino, welcome to Mentally Stronger.
Thanks, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we've never had an astronaut on the show, so I'm excited to talk to you. And loved your new book called Moonshot, A NASA Astronaut's Guide to Achieving the Impossible. So I had to say at first, I was thinking, well, what is an astronaut going to be able to tell us that the average person can relate to? You've done all of these amazing things and you went to outer space. Most of us will never do that. But in reading your book, I quickly realized that you have a lot of strategies that can help us mere mortals who will never make it into outer space.
Yeah, thanks. That was the idea of the book. And what I found is I was kind of surprised in some ways, I guess, that how much I had learned over my time at NASA does translate to everyday life. And I discovered that speaking to audiences of different types and sorts and backgrounds around the country over the time since I left NASA about 10 years ago, and how some of these stories really resonated with people. And I wasn't always able to know ahead of time what story would work. A lot of it came out of the question and answer time after, you know, after a keynote. People would ask me something and I would go into a story, and that seemed to, or a lesson, and a story that would teach a lesson, more or less, or illustrate a lesson. And those things seem to really resonate, those takeaways with people. And so that's what the book is. It's a series of stories and lessons that I learned as an astronaut that seem to resonate most with the people that I've spoken to.
And I want to get into some of those takeaways in a minute. But first, can you share your story? How did you decide you were going to become an astronaut, and when did that come about?
Well, I'm old enough to remember Neil Armstrong taking those first steps on the moon. I was 6 years old when that happened. And that really captured my heart and soul. And I thought this was so important. I wanted to grow up to be like Neil Armstrong and the other astronauts. I wanted to not just be an astronaut. I wanted to grow up to be like him. I thought he was really cool, and they were my heroes. And I followed the space program very closely, but I never really thought it could happen. I think by the time I was about 8 or 9, I started thinking about it. I was afraid of heights. I was scared of a lot of things. I think growing up, I was like, there's no way this can happen. By the time I was 8 or 9, I was like, this can't happen. And I kind of crossed it off the list of things that were possible in life. And when I went to college, I studied engineering, and I was a senior in college, and I went to the movies and saw this movie, The Right Stuff, which is based on Tom Wolfe's book of the same name. And it's about the original 7 astronauts and the test pilots that came before them. And it kind of rekindled that little boy dream I had. It never really died. It just was something I never thought was possible. And I still didn't necessarily think it was possible. But by this time in the 1980s, this is mid-1980s, the space shuttle was flying. And it wasn't just military test pilots like Neil Armstrong and my other heroes from way back when I was a little boy. It was now scientists and engineers and medical doctors, a lot of civilians. There were still a lot of test pilots and people from the military, but a lot of civilians as well. With the shuttle program, the first women were selected to be astronauts, the first people of color. So it seemed to be more of an opportunity for people who weren't just military test pilots. And I thought, I'm an engineer. Maybe I can at least try. And if that doesn't work, I can at least be part of the program. So I worked for a couple of years after college and went to grad school with the purpose of trying to get the experience and the education I needed to be a competitive candidate to try to be a NASA astronaut.
But it wasn't a smooth ride, right? You got rejected several times?
Yeah, I got rejected from nothing smooth. Nothing goes well. I think when something goes well, I'm always suspicious. Like, why was
right.
that? Why did that happen the first time? I learned those lessons, I think, in school growing up and playing sports, and there's disappointments and you just have to keep going. And in grad school, I failed my qualifying exam the first time I took it for my doctorate, and I really did poorly on it and was luckily given a second chance, and I was able to pull it out the second time. And with the astronaut application process, it wasn't any different. I was rejected 3 times before I was selected, and that included a medical disqualification along the way too that I had to overturn. So it was not smooth, but it was a very interesting path, and I was finally selected in 1996 to be a member of the astronaut class of 1996.
And do you want to talk about how you overcame the eyesight issue?
Sure. Yeah, that was that was a bit of a challenge. Things are different now. I was just yesterday, last evening, Woody Hoberg, a friend of mine who's a current astronaut, came into the program 21 years after I did. So he's still in there. He just got back from space, and he was visiting in New York. And I was asking him, what they've changed. I don't even know if there's a height requirement anymore. I'm 6'3" and a half. I was 6'4" was the limit, but they've thrown away a lot of those requirements. The eyesight requirement, you have to be correctable to 20/20, which is pretty reasonable, I think. You have to be able to see well enough, at least with glasses, but kind of like being able to drive a car. But, you had to see well without glasses or contacts, and they didn't accept LASIK. I don't even know if LASIK existed back then, 25 years ago, whenever it was when I was applying. And I failed the eye exam. I couldn't see well enough. And they disqualified me, which meant I couldn't even try again. They were like, that's it. You're medically disqualified. Unless I could overturn it. But how do you correct your eyesight when you can't do any medical procedure to help? So because that would be disqualifying anything that was available back then to change your eyesight medically with an operation or something wasn't acceptable. Again, this is all changed now. It's no longer the case. So I found out about something called vision training, where you could try to naturally improve your eyesight doing exercises. It was mainly done with children, I found out when I went to see the doctor about this. And yeah, but she was willing to, Dr. Hopping, this optometrist I met in Houston, was willing to try to help me. And I was able to pick up a couple lines on the eye chart so that at least I could overturn that medical disqualification. They accepted the new data and said, okay, you can see better now. That wasn't any guarantee. I still had to apply and go through all the hoops again. But I was able to apply that fourth time, and I got another an interview. So the interview is a whole week long of things. It's medical exams, and including the eye exam, and it's a selection board interview with the selection board and the social events. They get to know you really well during that week. So but I got another crack at it a couple years after my disqualification, and was able to pull through that time and got selected.
You know, I think it's one thing to be rejected because something, you didn't interview well or there was another problem, but to go back and say, I'm actually going to try again after being medically disqualified, especially something like your eyesight, like who wouldn't think that you could improve your eyesight? I don't know. So was there ever a point where you would have said, all right, I'm going to give up? Or what would that point have been when you wouldn't have tried again?
I don't think that point would have, I think I would have, you know, if I was disqualified and they said they wouldn't read my application, I probably would send it in anyway. I don't think I would have stopped. Even to this day, you know, there's a chapter in the book. The first chapter is kind of some of the stories we're talking about now is one in a million is not zero. Even as long as you're trying, even if the odds are like very low, as long as you try it, that doesn't mean it's a zero outcome. A zero probably of failure is non-zero. Probably of success is non-zero. It's only when you give up that it becomes zero. So I felt as long as I was trying, there was a chance, and that's the only thing I could control. I couldn't force them to take me, to pick me, to select me, but I knew I could at least control my effort. So I think I just would have tried to keep going. One of the things that kept me going too was, as you say, it wasn't that I didn't interview well or I was being told, no, this isn't for you. One of the good things I think was that as I got to meet more people and got to meet some of the astronauts and through the interview process, I felt very comfortable. I felt like those were my people. I wanted to be part of that organization. I actually thought I fit in well, except I couldn't pass the eye exam. So, you know, I was like, really, you know, just the, you know, I can't see well enough. That's really the problem. To me, it didn't seem like something that was worthy of stopping me. You know, if they would have told me, no, Mike, you know, you're just unqualified, or we just don't like you, or you're not going to fit in for this or this reason, you know, that's, what are you going to do there? That's, you know, that's maybe understandable. But the eyesight thing, although it's understandable, it just didn't sit right. And as I found, there are other astronauts too that I came across afterwards, who shared some of their stories too, that I don't include any of these in a book, but a lot of people got hurdles to overcome that were medical issues that they had to be creative about to try to overcome those. And so sometimes it's economic hurdles, sometimes it's educational, sometimes it's experience, and sometimes it's a physical issue. And you can't let any of that stuff stop you, I think, when you're trying to pursue something that you're passionate about. You just got to keep going and try to knock those things out of the way.
And now a quick word from our sponsor. Building physical strength is just as important to me as building mental strength. That's why I love drinking AG1 every day. Ever since I started drinking it, I feel energized and I feel more focused when I'm working. There's so much information out there, though, about supplements and nutrition that it feels overwhelming sometimes. But AG1 makes it simple. It's a nutrition supplement that supports your body's universal needs like gut optimization, stress management, and immune support. My producer started drinking AG1 instead of his morning coffee, and he says he now has sustained energy throughout the day. He even brought the travel packs with him when he went to Spain last week to go to the Latin Grammys, and he says AG1 helped him feel his best while he was on the road. I drink mine right before I go to the gym in the afternoons, and it helps me feel good about all the things I'm doing to take care of my mind and my body. AG1 is a supplement I trust to provide the support my body needs daily. If you want to take ownership of your health, it starts with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1/mentallystronger. That's drinkag1/mentallystronger. Check it out. Brainstorm. What's something that works so well that it's basically magic? Air conditioning? Noise-canceling headphones? Meeting-free Fridays? What about selling with Shopify? Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the did we just hit $1 million stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/mentallystronger, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/mentallystronger now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/mentallystronger. But there are a lot of kids, a lot of 10-year-olds out there who say, I want to be an astronaut when I grow up. The odds, like you found out when you did the math, were literally 1 in 1 million, right?
Yeah, weren't good. It wasn't very encouraging, but that was all right.
And you weren't deterred by that. I think most people, when they figure out the odds, they think, well, it'll be much easier to do something else in life. I'll be a mechanic here on planet Earth rather than try to go up and fix the Hubble Space Telescope. Mm-hmm. What do you think made you different that you said, I'm gonna try anyway?
I wanted more than anything to be a part of the astronaut office at NASA. I wanted to be a part of that team. I at that early age of six, when I was, and even before the Apollo 11 flight, I can remember Apollo 8 going to the moon, and Apollo 9 and Apollo 10 orbited the moon, did not land. They came very close to landing, but their mission was to test out the lunar module and come back. I remember all that stuff and how important it was. And I never lost sight of that importance in my mind. And that was, and still is my passion. Is other than my family, what I love in life is the space program. I think it's an absolute good. This is the way I see it. It's something that is worthwhile. It's about the future. It's inspirational. It allows for international cooperation. There are so many good things about it that I really wanted to be a part of it. And as I learned more about the actual job of being an astronaut, it was so much more than flying in space. It was being firsthand right there in the middle of decision making and how you were going to do things in space. And it was the best group of people I've ever encountered. And that wasn't just the astronauts, but our instructors and the people in mission control. And the more I found out about it, I worked in Houston as an engineer for McDonnell Douglas, an aerospace company, as a research engineer at the Johnson Space Center, and got to meet lots of people. And the more I learned about it, the more I liked it and the more I felt comfortable there, which was kind of odd. You know, I was intimidated by just about everything, because to me, it was just so cool. And these were my heroes that I was getting to know. But at the same time, I felt really comfortable with them. I really loved the culture. I loved the people, their attitude, the way that they pursued their jobs and their personal lives too. And I wanted to be a part of it. And you know, these are things that I try to that I learned at that those years at NASA that I try to share in the book.
And then you were given a job to go fix the Hubble Space Telescope twice, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. That was a good job. Yep.
Were there ever times when you thought, I mean, you risked your life, were there's ever moments where you thought, is this worth it?
I think that happens to, I think everybody, you know, when you're working hard, it was the risking the life was one thing, but it was also a lot of work. The job, the astronaut job is really a job, and it's, you know, it's not glamorous. It's not, you know, going for training one morning and flying in the afternoon. It's not a tour. It was, you know, the astronaut job. Even this guy, my friend Woody, who I mentioned earlier, was selected in 2017 and just flew early this year and got back. So, you know, you're talking about years of training and working hard before you get a chance to fly. And there's a lot of hard work involved. There's a lot of late nights. There's a lot of weekends. There's a lot of missing holidays and birthdays and anniversaries. And there is that danger involved there too. And you know, you're compensated well, but you're a government employee. We didn't get any hazardous duty pay. We didn't get any flight time. I would have basically worked for free. So we were very happy getting paid like the standard government rate and no frills. And that was okay because we were so passionate about our job. And but still, it was something that I think you had to remind yourself of why you're doing it. And I felt it was certainly worth the risk. I think a dream is worth the risk. It's not good, I think, to be doing something that you don't feel passionate about. And I feel very lucky that I had something that I felt so passionate about that I was willing to risk my life. And to me, I think that's a blessing to have that in life. And with the Hubble, to me, it was pretty straightforward. It was a really cool flight because it was a lot of spacewalking and we got to design new tools and techniques. And it was, for me, it was engineers and an astronaut's dream to be part of that team on those two missions that you mentioned. So I felt the science coming out of the Hubble was worth the effort as well. My first flight, we installed an instrument about the size of a refrigerator called the Advanced Camera for Surveys. And that was used, the observations that the astronomers made with that instrument resulted in the discovery of dark energy, which led to the awarding of a Nobel Prize. And the James Webb Telescope has launched about a year and a half ago, or almost 2 years now, launched in December, 2 years ago. But we started seeing images about a year and a half ago, and we still see some great images from the new telescope. And there was a documentary that just was made, an IMAX documentary that I went to the opening. And a lot of the scientists from James Webb were also the scientists from Hubble. And this guy, Matt Mountain, who is the head of the Space Telescope Science Institute, was there. And he was running the Space Telescope Science Institute takes in all the data and handles who's going to use the observatory and what discoveries and were made and so on, kind of oversees all that. And, he still says, we owe you guys such a debt of gratitude for what you did. And, he mentioned the Nobel Prize. I'm like, yeah, well, I didn't win the Nobel Prize. You guys won the Nobel Prize. And he goes, well, we couldn't have done it without you. And, maybe that's true. There's probably a lot of other astronauts could have done exactly what we did, but we were the ones that got to do it. And so I felt very fortunate that I was put in that position to do something that I felt was so worthwhile.
But it didn't go 100% smoothly, right? There's a story you tell in the book about how you stripped the screw.
Yeah, that was on my second flight. Every spacewalk that I was either outside performing or inside helping with, because when you're not, we had two teams of spacewalkers, two people each on both of my missions. So when the other guys are outside, you're inside trying to help them. And when you're outside, they're helping you, going through the checklist and trying to help you problem solve. But every one of those had something go wrong. There's always something that you didn't plan for, that you didn't know about, something was different, or you just make a mistake. And the worst of that happened to me, which ended up with a very good ending, was I stripped a screw trying to remove a handrail to do a repair on an instrument. It was the most complicated spacewalk we had ever attempted because this instrument was no longer working. We had never tried to repair an instrument on orbit. We would just remove the broken instrument, put a new one in, but we didn't have a replacement for this one. And so it was over 100 new tools were designed for this task, and it was on my day and trained for years with lots of help. And I just made a real, really bonehead mistake. I stripped a screw on this handrail and couldn't remove it. Luckily, it was loose at the top, and one of our engineers on the ground, the guy by the name of Jim Corbo, thought about what he would do in his garage. He would just use brute force and rip the thing off. And that was a good solution. And they had to test that. We didn't have much time to figure this out. And I didn't know what was going on. I'm in space, just kind of trying to do the best I can and troubleshoot and trying to live through this nightmare that I created. And they did a test at the Goddard Space Flight Center, where they got another instrument and put a handrail in the same configuration and pulled on it with a fish scale, and it read 60 pounds when it broke the screw. And so they thought I could try to just rip it off, and that's what ended up working. And and I think about that, it was a real bonehead move, but in the investigation it showed that the reason it happened was that bolt required more torque than the others. We didn't know that ahead of time. They put more glue on the threads of that one and on the others, because they did a bit of an investigation after to see if they understood, why did this happen? So really, they could say it wasn't my fault, but I'm the guy that did it. And if felt terrible about it at the time. But I, looking back on it, I think that what got me through that was just that perseverance we talked about earlier of not giving up. I wasn't going to give up there either. I was not feeling good about what had happened, but I also wasn't going to give up. We were going to see it through the end of that spacewalk, at least, and see what we could do. And so I think that sometimes, I think that persistence to get you to a position you want to be in is also important to remember what got you there. And that's what you're going to need to be successful when the chips are down.
And then that's a theme that runs throughout your book. And you talk a lot about owning your mistakes, but also having a team, that it's not 100% up to you, but to be able to have a team you can rely on, reaching out to other people, calling out something as soon as you see it, and putting all of those things together clearly. And that's what worked for you in that moment as well.
Yep. Yeah. You know, you don't want to make mistakes, but when you do, you know, it's okay to be regretful about it. There's a chapter in the book. It's entitled 30 Seconds of Regret. It's okay to be disappointed when you mess something up, but you also got to get back in the game and let people help you when, you know, don't think you have to solve everything yourself. And certainly that's the way we were trained. I was speaking to my buddy last night. We had an event with the students at Columbia. I'm referring to my friend Woody again. And they asked him what he learned at NASA. And he said, he got comfortable with making mistakes, which we don't. That's because you're going to make them, you know, you're doing, it's not anything is that complicated, but people, we make mistakes doing everything, right? You just mess up a lot and you got to get comfortable with that, because if you beat yourself up too much for too long, you'll never try anything again. I think you don't want to make, the only way you're going to make mistakes, the only way you can try stuff is to be comfortable messing it up every once in a while.
Yeah. So I love that you talked about that in the book, about owning it and then moving on. What was your experience with coming back to Earth after being in outer space?
It was an adjustment, but I miss my time at NASA. I miss my friends. I miss the work we did, the engineering work we did. Why don't you ask me a little more specifically? What do you mean by adjustment? Are you thinking in what way?
So I'm thinking about, I've always heard the story that when Buzz Aldrin came back, he thought, after seeing what Earth looked like from outer space, he thought, now I'm never going to see anything quite that cool ever again in my life. The story goes that once he came back to Earth, he struggled with substance use, with mental health issues, and a lot of it was thought to be because the best time of his life was already behind him. I don't know him. I don't know how much of that is true. I've never asked him, but curious, like, how do you do that? You go out and you see this amazing thing. When you come back to Earth and you start looking around, things are still cool, but maybe not quite as cool as what you just saw.
Yeah, I think that, well, that's certainly the case. But it sounds a little harsh on Buzz there, truthfully. I think, he might have had his struggles, but I think what's interesting about him is that he's still alive and doing well. And now he must be... You know, he's in his mid-90s now, but he's still out there, talking to people and trying to educate folks about what's going on in the space program. One of his crewmates, I thought, summed it up pretty well, which Mike Collins wrote a book called Carrying the Fire. And Mike Collins unfortunately passed a couple of years ago, but I got to know him as well. And one of my heroes, right? My Apollo 11 heroes, and Neil Armstrong too is in there, right? But in his book, and I've heard him say this too, Mike Collins talks about how he had to come to the realization that the most interesting job he was ever going to have in his life, he had in his, you know, his late 30s when he was, I forget what time he was. He probably was in his early, I think I know Neil Armstrong was 38 years old when he walked on the moon, and Mike and Buzz were probably around that age, right? So, and that's just the way it is. And I think that's true, that you're not going to be able to replicate that. You know, you're going to get older, and this time you have that was being an astronaut, that was glorious, is no longer part of your life like it was. But that doesn't mean that life isn't good any longer. It means just you're in a different phase. And I think how you react to that is important. You can be upset about it, or you can be grateful for what you have and move forward with that to make a difference in your life and other people's lives. I think one of the really good examples is Alan Bean, who I talk about quite often in the book, who was the fourth person to walk on the moon. And after he left the astronaut office, he decided to pursue his dream of painting. He was also an artist, which is kind of unusual for a person to be a engineer, test pilot, astronaut, you know, that and right brain, left brain stuff, and then also be a very talented artist. I mean, his paintings are amazing. And what he got to do was paint his memories on the moon. And he was able to paint things that never happened on the moon that he wished he would have done on the moon, like throw a football with his friend. I mean, that wasn't part of the flight plan, but he depicts that. He has this, my favorite image that he has, the famous, my favorite painting of his, and I have a little lithograph of it that I flew two of them in space, one for Alan and one for me. And I signed his and he signed mine. So it's called the Fantasy. And it's him with his two best friends. He flew in space with his two best friends, Pete Conrad, who he walked on the moon with, and another guy named Dick Gordon. And they were really good friends from the Navy and as astronauts. And they're buried near each other in Arlington National Cemetery. They were very close friends, the three of them. They've all passed now. But Dick Gordon had to stay in orbit around the moon. He didn't get a chance to go down to the moon with his friends. He stayed in orbit around the moon, and they had to go down and come back up. So Alan has this painting. It's called The Fantasy, with the three of them on the moon, you know, and one of them is putting the bunny ears behind the other guy's head. So he was able to do that, and also became a mentor to me and many other astronauts. He spoke to every astronaut class and told us all the things that he had learned. And I think that in that case, there's an example of someone who took the opportunity they had as an astronaut. And when that was done, they moved on to do something else. And that doesn't mean that it's any better or worse. It just means it's different. And you have opportunities that he was able to do artwork that no one else could do because he was an artist that experienced a moon, what it was like on the moon. Other moonwalkers couldn't paint, and we haven't sent an artist up there yet, really, who could paint like that. So he was able to do that uniquely. And I guess the way I looked at it was, when I was done with my flying, I wanted to go back to teaching. I was a professor at Georgia Tech right before I was selected. And I only did that for less than a year. And then I got picked by NASA and left Atlanta and went back to Houston. But I thought, well, I that little experience of teaching at a university, I liked, and that's what I'm doing now at Columbia. And I like telling the stories. I enjoy speaking to you about it. I enjoy writing the book and telling people about what I learned. And for me, that's how I'm able to not forget about everything that I learned and relive it just about every day, because I'm talking about it to somebody every day, it seems. So you can look at it, I guess you can look at it in different ways, but I would say it is true that that's probably the most interesting job any of us are going to have ever. But there is a lot you can do with it after, and you can look at some really interesting things that astronauts have done after they've left the astronaut office.
I like that idea that, yes, you can still take what you learn and do something slightly different with it. As a therapist, I'll have sometimes people who retire and then they're like, well, mm-hmm. who am I now that I'm no longer a doctor, or now that I'm no longer a football player? Like, who am I mm-hmm. in life? And to figure out that new identity and not looking at it that, yes, the best years of my life are behind me, or the coolest thing I ever did was 30 years ago and I'll never do anything that cool again.
Yeah.
And in fact, in your book, you talk about one of the important things for us to carry forward would be to always be amazed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. And I think you might've been going there with your question earlier about when you see the planet and you come back and so on. This is an amazing place we live on. And we all maybe kind of know that or see beautiful things on the planet. But I think that Earth was meant to be seen in its true beauty from space. And we were at a very high altitude for the space shuttle, 100 miles higher than when the space station flies when we went to Hubble. So we could see the Earth, the curvature of the Earth in its entirety. It took up our whole field of view, but you could see it as a gigantic ball, a big planet. And it is just beautiful. I felt like I was looking into paradise, like I was looking into heaven. And I had the thought that, you know, there can be nothing more beautiful than where we live. Maybe this is heaven. And I look differently at the planet. You know, I can look around my camera and look out my window and see trees, right? We got kind of like in a forest setting in the back there. And it's just absolutely gorgeous with the fall leaves and the blue sky and people that live here. And there's a lot of bad stuff going on, but there's also a lot of beauty. And I think that it's important for us to remember that we live in an amazing world. We have things that we can do with technology that are incredible, like what we're doing now. And we can have relationships with people and friendships and look around and see some amazing things, no matter where you are. I mean, even if you're in a beautiful setting, or if you're in a city, I think is also a beautiful setting. You look at the architecture and the buildings and the hustle. I live in New York City, so I get to enjoy that a lot too. So I think we have to sometimes remember how lucky we are to be here. And especially when times get tough, to try to have those good thoughts that can make us appreciate what a miracle it is that we're here in the first place.
And one last question I wanted to ask you about. My favorite quote from your book is, you said, "There's more to life out there, and you owe it to yourself to find out what that is."
Ooh, that's a good one. I wrote that.
Right? You did. You did. And it really stood out to me.
I'm going to write that down. That's right? A good one. Thank you.
And I think if we all just kept that in mind, like, we owe it to ourselves to find out what that is, that's much different than the world. We deserve something just because we worked hard, or that the world owes us something. But instead of saying, no, I should, it's up to me to find out what those great things are.
Yeah, no, you're right. And in the book also, I talk about some of the advice. I mentioned Alan Bean, just what you said about the world doesn't owe you a thing. When I was leaving NASA, I would see him quite often. I would see him once or twice a year. I would go visit him if I hadn't seen him for a while. He lived in Houston, Alan did, just to get some good advice from him. And when I was thinking of leaving the office, that's the guy I got a lot of really good advice from. And I remember he was, I talk about this in the book, he was walking me out to the car after this conversation we had. And he said, "Mike, I have one more thing to tell you." He goes, never, wherever you end up after whatever your decision is about leaving or staying or whatever you're going to do, don't ever feel entitled to anything. It doesn't matter that you were had a successful career as an astronaut and risked your life and didn't make a lot of money. And that doesn't matter, right? That does not matter. And if you feel that you're entitled to something, you'll never be happy. And you're just setting yourself up for misery. And I think that's really good advice. Don't ever expect anything. Don't feel entitled that I did this and now I deserve this. No, you don't. You do your best and have that passion and do what you do, hopefully because you love it or you think it's the right thing to do, and never expect anything. But at the same time, I think you owe it to yourself to give yourself your dream a chance. And why not? You owe it to yourself. You owe it to that person inside of you to do the best you can to fulfill whatever dream or interest you might have. And you're going to get knocked down probably and told no and have obstacles, but you really owe it to yourself. I'm glad I wrote that. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's, I think, very true. That, the odds may be against you, but you owe it to yourself to give it a try.
And you're a perfect example of somebody that did just that and got knocked down many times and kept getting back up. And here you are. And now in your post-NASA days, you're still doing some amazing things, like writing books so that we can learn from you, and you were on the Big Bang Theory. You get to do some cool stuff. To still, talk about these things and the lessons that you learned. So thank you so much for doing that. For our listeners who want to learn more about you, where's the best place for them to go?
The best place to learn about me, I guess, is my website. I appreciate you asking. It's mikemassimino.com. You get it right now. If you go there, you'll get hit in the face with information about the book. So so if you're interested in learning more in more detail, the book is there if you're inclined. But my website has some info about me and videos and speech topics and other stuff on there. That's probably the best place to go.
We will link to it in our show notes.
Oh, you're awesome. Thank you so much.
Mike Massimino, thank you so much for being on Mentally Stronger.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Welcome to The Therapist Take. It's the part of the show where I'll give you my take on Mike's strategies that you can start using in your everyday life to grow mentally stronger. Here are three of my favorite strategies that he shared. One, get creative when you encounter an obstacle. The odds were stacked against Mike when he tried to become an astronaut. Many people want the job. Very few people get picked. When he got rejected because of his vision problems, his chances were almost non-existent. And most of us, including me, probably would have walked away at that point. But he didn't give up, and he figured out how to try and improve his vision. Just to be clear, though, I don't believe in the saying, never give up. I think too many people stick with things far too long, and it costs them their health or their relationships or their money. But I do believe in creative problem solving. If it makes sense to keep going, and you look for creative ways to overcome challenges, you might find that you can do things that once seemed impossible. Two, give yourself permission to make mistakes. You might expect an astronaut to say, there's no room for a single mistake, because in their field, a mistake could be deadly. But Mike says he expected to encounter problems and he expected to make some mistakes. He also stresses the importance of pointing out your mistakes right away so that you can get help. This is tough even when you're not in a life or death situation. You might hide your mistake at work or try to cover something up because you don't want anyone to notice. But when you accept that mistakes are going to happen, when they actually do happen, you can put your energy into working on the issue, not trying to just cover it up. And three, always look for opportunities that will help you stay excited about life. I don't think Mike liked my question about the story of Buzz Aldrin and whether going to outer space actually caused problems for him when he returned because he thought the best time of his life was behind him. But I liked how he said he continues to make sure that life stays fun and exciting. Even though his days of being in outer space are over, he doesn't look at it that the best of his life is behind him. That's important. As a therapist, I encounter a lot of people who struggle with this. They think the best years of their lives were when the kids were home, or maybe before they had kids, or when they were younger. But if you draw that conclusion that the best years of your life are already behind you, you'll make it true. What if you have an attitude that the best part is yet to come? You'll probably make that true as well. So those are three of Mike's strategies that you can start putting into practice today. Get creative when you encounter an obstacle. Expect to make mistakes, and always look for opportunities that will help you stay excited about life. To learn more about Mike, go pick up a copy of his new book, Moonshot. Thank you for hanging out with us today and for listening to Mentally Stronger. If you know someone who could benefit from learning about how to build mental strength, share this show with them. Simply sharing a link to this episode could help someone feel better and grow stronger. And as always, a big thank you to my show's producer, who's good at doing things that might seem impossible, Nick Valentine.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.